Welcome to our first book club discussion. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Our guest is Eric Weiner. He is an award-winning journalist, a best-selling author, and was a foreign correspondent for NPR. And we're talking with him about the first of his four books. This one, The Geography of Bliss, One Grump's Search for the Happiest Places in the World. And like any book club, we want you to join in the discussion. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. What would you like to ask Eric? What did you think of the book? How do you think where you live affects how happy you are? You can join in. Even if you didn't read the book, I hope you'll join in too. I know a lot of people have. Again, the number is 800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Eric Weiner, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
I am happy to be with you.
Well, I'm happy that you're here. You talk about your book as a, or you describe it, I guess, as a philosophical, humorous travel memoir. Is that what you set out to write?
I don't know if I set out to write that, but that's how it turned out. I think when you set out to write a book, you should have a vague idea of where you're heading, but you shouldn't necessarily know what the destination is. It's sort of writing a book is a lot like travel that way. If you've got everything figured out ahead of time, you might as well stay home.
Yeah. Well, you describe yourself, or at least did when you wrote the book, as kind of a grumpy guy. What were your thoughts on happiness maybe before you did the research?
Yeah, well, the truth is I was more of a malcontent than a grump, but true story, my publisher thought grump was a better word, less more monosyllabic, less French-sounding. I would say I've always had a sort of white noise of unhappiness, I call it, in my life. Like not, you know, if you're old enough to remember vinyl in its first incarnation, and I suspect you may be, you remember that,
yes,
that, you know, turntables would talk about wow and flutter and all these things that would sort of distort the fidelity of the sound. And that was me. I always had this background of unhappiness and discontent in my life, even as I achieved a lot of my career goals, becoming a foreign correspondent for NPR and traveling the world. So I decided to take those skills as a journalist and apply them not to war or some other catastrophe, but apply them to the good parts of life, to the happy places and the happy people, and see what I could learn from them.
Yeah. And I guess before you measure happiness or maybe how happy a person is, you need a kind of a common definition of happiness, don't you? How do you define it?
Well, I think to some extent you do, but one of the purposes for my book was to come up with a definition, right? and the word has evolved, or rather devolved, over the centuries. I mean, back in ancient Greece, when Aristotle was writing about happiness, or eudaimonia, as they called it then, it was very much linked with a virtuous life, with a good life. Like if you were to ask Aristotle, could you be a happy bank robber? He would say, no, you could not be, because you're doing something that's not virtuous. It's unethical, stealing other people's money. Today we have a much more of a smiley face image or definition of happiness, that you could be a happy bank robber, that, you know, you could have a life that's happy even if you do bad things. And one of the things I wrestle with in the book is what exactly do we mean by happiness, and should we define it upwards instead of downwards?
Yeah. And happiness definitions, or how people define it in the various countries that you lived, were different oftentimes.
Yeah, I mean, every country and every culture has a word for happiness, so it's sort of universal that way, but exactly how they define it does differ. You know, in the West and in the U.S. in particular, we tend to define happiness very much in personal terms, right? We're working on our personal happiness. Well, I met a man in Bhutan, in the Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan, named Karma, who told me he thought that was absurd, that there was no such thing as personal happiness, that happiness is relative, in that it is a social phenomenon. It's not an I that is happy, but a we, and that your happiness is really dependent on your relationships, the quantity to some extent, but really the quality of your relationships. And that's very different from how I had thought of happiness. I thought of happiness as like, you know, my physique or my career, things I worked on myself and had very little to do with other people except for my trainer or my career advisor. And writing this book changed my mind about what it means to be happy.
Yeah, I think you point out some research, some social scientist research that showed, I think, 70% of the happiness component comes from our relationships.
At least that. There have been other studies that show it's even higher. There was one famous study called the Framingham Study out of Massachusetts and Harvard, and they looked at people over the course of an entire lifetime and found the one variable that predicted not only their happiness but their physical health as well was their relationships. Did they have close friends? Did they have intimate relationships? Were they, were they isolated or not? And it matters a lot.
Well, let's talk about more expansively here about the book. For those who didn't read it, perhaps explain how you decided on where to travel and so forth.
Well, it was partly scientific and partly personal, much like happiness. Part of it was beginning at the World Database of Happiness in Rotterdam in the Netherlands, where they compile all this data on who's happy and where people are happy and where they are. And I chose some countries that were at the very top of the list that I thought were surprising. Switzerland in the top five consistently, yet it is kind of a boring country, was my impression, to be honest. Iceland in the top three consistently, despite the fact that it's this cold, isolated, tiny country in the North Atlantic. So those were places that were empirically happy based on these studies, but surprisingly so. And then there were other places that may not be the happiest places in the world, but I thought they would be interesting experiments. You know, I treated the world as this laboratory of ideas. In other words, kind of a happiness lab. If you think that money buys happiness, then what better place to test that hypothesis than in Qatar, which is on a per capita basis, that Persian Gulf country is the wealthiest in the world. So I chose places like that as well. And places like Bhutan, where they're doing lots of interesting experiments with happiness, including this whole policy, which we can talk about, if you like, of gross national happiness.
Yeah, I really want to talk with you about that as we move along today. Iceland and Denmark, being on the top of the happiness scale, Iceland was a really interesting country. I've never visited Iceland, and I found it extremely interesting. And by the way, your book, there were many times in your book where I just burst out laughing while I was reading. You're a great writer. Let me say that right off. And I really enjoyed seeing what you had to say about every one of those countries.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And Iceland is a special place. I mean, it is, these are the descendants of the Vikings, and the Icelandic language most closely resembles the ancient Viking language more than any other Nordic or Scandinavian country. And it's small. It's a population of, when I was there, about 320,000 in the whole country. And yet it produces, more books per capita than any country in the world, musicians like Bjork and many others. And they also, they have a fluidity to life there that I found very admirable. They will switch from, not just from one job to another, but from one career to another, just effortlessly, without anyone saying, well, what are you doing? You were a banker yesterday and you're a musician today. It's okay in Iceland.
Yeah, it is indeed. And I think one of the interesting things for me was you're writing about how they view failure. They sort of embrace failure.
They do. And I think in a more genuine way than we embrace failure. I think we like to think it's okay to fail in America, but really it's okay to fail if that's the backstory to great success. The story of someone who came up with 10 ideas, and they all failed, and the 11th was Apple Computer. So that makes for a good story. But in Iceland, they find something heroic in failure itself. In a weird way, it's better to fail than to succeed, I think, as far as the Icelanders are concerned. And you don't carry this stigma with you for the rest of your life. You're allowed to get back on that horse and try again. And I met many people like that. And I think it can be incredibly liberating.
Yeah. Our guest today, Eric Weiner, his book is The Geography of Bliss. Great to have him with us. And we'll give you a chance to join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. And let's take some calls. Sarah in Zion, Illinois. We'll go to you. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Eric. My question is about the study you were talking about how people with good relationships are healthier and happier. Did that study look at people who didn't have good human relationships, but they had pets? And did that, could having pets offset your lack of human relationships much?
Well, that's a good question. Should I take it?
Yeah. I was trying to think if pets ever came into
They did.
Book.
They did in England when I went to the UK, and that's a country where they probably. I think this is fair to say that they feel more warmly toward their pets than they do toward their fellow humans. They love their animals in Britain, and they certainly find happiness there. I think the research shows that pets are a good backup or a good supplement to human relationships, but are not a substitute for human relationships. In other words, can you, have no friends or family or any connections, but have, a pet cat or dog who you love that's better than nothing, but not as good as having solid and healthy human relations?
All right. There you go, Sarah. Thank you. Ron in Crandon, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Ron.
Hey, guys. I really, really enjoyed the book. I'm going to go kind of machine gun here because there were so many different concepts, but it kind of seemed to me in reading it that one of the real basis of this is trust and that how much happiness is connected to it. And I know you mentioned it specifically a few times, but sometimes even the other main points kind of are underlined with trust, a trust in your government to take care of you if you fail, a trust in your friends. I think even envy is kind of based in a lack of trust. And it seems like the government and the media and things that occur right now are really, really tearing that trust down. And even, friend networks and those type of things, advertising, telling us that what happiness is supposed to be. And I wonder what your thoughts are on trust. And I will I'll take your comments off the phone. But I wanted to end by saying, if you really want happiness, just listen to Larry's show every single day, because there isn't that. There's always some, even if they're difficult topics, there seem to be pleasant, happy people presenting them. And again, really appreciated the book.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, there we have it, Larry. We found the secret to happiness is listening to your show. one geography of bliss is centered somewhere in Wisconsin. So, really good, good point there about trust. It is hugely important, and sort of shows you that reveals how much happiness is a social phenomenon as much as a personal phenomenon, even more so. Switzerland, for instance, very high levels of trust. Simple things like you pump and then you pay for your gas. You don't have to pay ahead of time. You go to the Swiss Alps and you go hiking, and there are these little huts where there's food out there and a little jar, and you take some food and put some money in the jar. I mean, it's very trusting. I don't know if that would work in the U.S. if people would take the money and the food. But in all seriousness, trust is important. I don't think it necessarily comes from the government or trust of the government. I always view governments as extensions of cultures, and if there's a culture of trust, in a nation, you're more likely to have a government that is trustworthy. But the opposite of trust is, to some extent, is envy, which I write about, and how envy is toxic to happiness. In Moldova, which I visited, the least happy country in the world, I mean, envy is like the national pastime. You know, they say better to succeed is to see your neighbor fail. And that's not a healthy attitude for a happy society. And I do worry about what's going on in this country. You know, if I were to ask a simple question, overall, most people can be trusted. Do you think that's agree with that statement or disagree? Larry?
I would agree. I think most people, you know, it's what are most, at least better than 50%.
Well, I mean, it's meant to be an open-ended sort of question where you can fill it in as you like. But, you know, when they asked people, Americans in the 1960s, that question, people said, yes, over 2/3 of respondents said, yes, overall, most people can be trusted. When they repeated it some 40 years later, it flipped. And 2/3 said, no, most people cannot be trusted. And that's worrisome. It's worrisome for American happiness in American society, because if you don't have trust, you don't have anything, really.
Eric Weiner, our guest today for our first book club meeting. His book is The Geography of Bliss. And you can join in, too. We have some callers online. We'll get to Ed and Don in just a minute. But I want to remind you that we have a great engineer today, Tyler Ditter, a great producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Talking with Eric Weiner on the show today for our book club, and the book is The Geography of Bliss, One Grump's Search for the Happiest Places in the World. I'm having a great time talking with him. I'm hoping you're enjoying it too, and I hope you'll join in. You can call us at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Ed in Toma, we'll go to you now. Ed, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I have two comments. The first is, a wise man once said, to be truly happy, one must not want. And my own personal one is, to be happy, do the right thing. And I'm enjoying your show.
Thank you for the
comments off the air.
Thank you, Ed. Appreciate it. Well, what do you think, Eric?
I didn't fully hear the quote there. Can you repeat it to me, or the essence of it?
Ed, are you still there? Now it's suddenly left. Happiness was not wanting, I think.
I think the point is being happy by doing the right thing as well. And
that was one, yeah.
Yeah. I think, again, that goes back to the ancient Greek notion of happiness, or eudaimonia, which was very much tied up with the virtuous life, doing the right thing and being happy for the right reasons. And it just happens that we are wired that way, that being altruistic makes you happier. I mean, there are studies after studies that show that if you give money to others, you get a happiness bonus from that. You get a boost in your happiness. So it doesn't have to be an either or. Either you're a good person or you're a happy person. There's a lot of overlap, but it's not 100%. And what I mean by that is if you were to ask a single working mother of three if she was happy, she'd likely say you're asking the wrong question. My life is meaningful. My life is rich. I am needed. But am I happy in the sense of, you know, experiencing pleasure a lot of the time? Probably not.
Thanks for that call. Don in Tower Lakes, Illinois. We'll go to you next. Hi, Don.
Hey, I was intrigued by Eric's comment that in Iceland, failure is treated as some sort of a badge of honor. That's somehow weird in our own country. In the state of Wisconsin, for the last half dozen years, we've been putting in Fab Lab programs in K-12 school districts. I've been very involved in that. And we're telling the students that failure actually is going to be more common than success. And it frees you to be happy when you know that there's not something wrong with you because you did something wrong, and that the path to success is often failure. I just was wondering what Eric's thoughts on that would be.
Yeah. Eric?
Well, I mean, I subscribe to the Icelandic theory of failure, too, which is that failure doesn't necessarily have to be the prerequisite, the prelude to success. That there's something, and this is a subtle distinction, I think, with the American way, is failure that does not lead to success, there's something noble in and of itself. And if nothing else, it allows you to keep throwing darts at the board. You know, I wrote a book called The Geography of Genius, where I explore the most creative places around the world and creative people. And I came across this anecdote involving Linus Pauling, who was a two-time Nobel Prize-winning scientist. And when he was older in life, a young student said, you know, Dr. Pauling, how do you come up with so many brilliant ideas? He says, well, it's easy. I come up with lots of ideas and I throw away the bad ones. And that that approach to failure and success can be very healthy and very productive. The truth is that geniuses, however you define it, they have more failures and more, you know, bad poems and bad equations than do successful people, but they just keep going.
Oh. Well, thank you for that call. Let's take another call. Let's see. Chris in Racine. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It seems to me that happiness is sometimes the avoidance of anxiety. And also your interactions with people may not be a significant other, but you can have meaningful interactions at making eye contact with a sales clerk and wishing them a sincere good day and having them meet your eyes in return. Letting somebody into traffic that is trying to leave a service station in heavy traffic, and they smile and they wave at you because you halted and let them in. Those are meaningful interactions that give you a sense of pleasure, and pleasure can be defined as happiness as well. So, and sometimes it's just looking for things that you see that are good, like, the sky is blue today, very blue, and I like that white cloud. You have to actually search for happiness and make sure that you're looking for it at all times.
Hmm. Chris, thank you. A comment, Eric.
Well, I agree that happiness is very much tied up with gratitude and having a grateful attitude toward the world at large and toward your life. I also agree that there is, and we have to make a distinction between happiness and pleasure. They're not exactly the same at all. And you can have a life of pleasure but not be very happy, and you can have a happy life that isn't necessarily filled with pleasure 24/7. I mean, I think pleasure tends to be more fleeting, more sensory, and happiness is an assessment of your life overall. So when they do these surveys, they try to figure out who's happy and where and why. They ask a very simple question, and that is this: overall, how happy would you say you are these days? And it requires you to step back and to assess your life and not to say, in this particular moment, I'm having a pleasurable experience. So that's one point I would make. And the other, as the caller said about these interactions with strangers, I've been thinking about that a lot and how the pandemic has, you know, robbed us of these interactions. And that is one thing that I really miss, is I don't really need to spend more time with my family, and they don't need to spend more time with me. They're spending lots of time with me. I miss those interactions with strangers, which can be gratifying, and it can add up, you know, the barista in a coffee shop or a clerk in a grocery store or whatever it is. And we have been robbed of these to a large extent. And I think we now realize how much, even though they seem trivial at the time, taken as a whole, they add up to something very gratifying.
Oh, thank you very much, Chris. Again, you can join in with your own thoughts on this or questions about the book. The number 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, Mark and Sue emailed to ask, if you had to choose to live in one of the countries you visited in this book, which country would it be? Pretty sure not Moldova.
No, not Moldova. Nothing would have me, frankly. That's a tough one. I mean, I'd probably have to say India, not because it's the happiest country in the world. It's not, but because, you know, it's never boring. And it was my first assignment as a foreign correspondent for NPR. And the range of humanity from worst to best, back to worst, is all to be found in one street corner in any Indian city. So I'd probably have to say India, actually.
There you go. Oh, well, let's talk about some more of the places that you visited. And our culture was, you know, kind of an important part of the happiness equation. You might talk about how the lack of it influenced people in some of the places you visited.
Well, I mean, this is the conundrum of the relationship between happiness and the arts, I think. And in a country like Qatar, which is a relatively new nation state, which has been flooded with money thanks to oil and natural gas deposits, but they didn't have a rich cultural history, at least in terms of arts and music. They had some, but they wanted more, and they had all this money, so they've been trying essentially to import culture and to start museums by using money to attract exhibits and musicians, et cetera. And you can do that up to a point, but culture is organic, and it has to grow organically, and large infusions of cash don't really help in that regard. But all the happy countries I visited had rich cultural traditions, whether it's music, arts, whatever it is. And getting back to Iceland, you know, I had coffee. I visited Iceland in January because I wanted to see it at its darkest. And it's, you know, it's noon and it's dark outside, and I'm having coffee with an Icelandic composer named Hilmar, and he composes beautiful music for Hollywood scores. He's very successful, but it's very haunting, sad music. Yet Hilmar seems happy. And so I asked him in so many words, what's going on? You seem to be this happy guy in this happy country, but your music is so sad, beautifully sad. And he said, well, I am happy overall, but I cherish my melancholia. And I think there's great truth in that, that even the happiest people in the happiest places, they never erase melancholy and sadness from their lives entirely. They make room for it. They accommodate it. And in a way, as Hilmar suggested, they even cherish it and express it through their music. And that's one of the functions of culture, is, you know, not pleasure, but a way to transform suffering into something richer and more meaningful.
Yeah. Well, Sue in Janesville, let's go to you now. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm enjoying the discussion, although I haven't yet read the book. Well, but I did hear on NPR, and I can't tell you who was the guest, making the point that the Scandinavian countries have very well-ordered societies that serve their public well, and yet they are the least church-going or religious in that context of any European countries. So I wondered if he had any response to that, or possibly this is something that was in a discussion of his book that I heard earlier.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And the relationship between religion and happiness is a tricky one. And by that, I mean, if you look at surveys, say, within the U.S., people who self-identify as religious, as defined as going to church or synagogue or mosque, you know, a certain number of times per week, these people tend to be happier, again, in self-reports, because that's what happiness is. It is subjective. But these people report being happier. And now the question researchers have been scratching their heads over is, why would that be? Is it because of their connection to a deity, their spiritual nourishment they get through religion? Or might it be something else, like exercise? They probably walk to church on Sundays, or they might be involved in church groups, for instance. And we know that, as we've been saying, that sociability is hugely important for happiness. So trying to tease out why in the U.S. people who are religious are happier than those who aren't is tricky. And then you look globally, and as the caller points out, some of the happiest countries in the world tend to have very low amounts of religiosity, such as the Netherlands or Iceland to some extent, and the other Scandinavian countries. And, you know, my sort of freelance hypothesis on this is that you need to have something to believe in, that a country where people didn't believe in anything would not be a very happy one. And that thing, though, does not need to believe to be one God or to be a religion. The Scandinavians have very strong beliefs about many things, and it holds them together. For a lot of people, that belief system is religion, but I don't think it needs to be.
Yeah. Well, I remember in your chapter on Switzerland, you asked someone, why are the Swiss so happy? And somebody said, well, because we know we can always kill ourselves.
Yeah, he was joking a little bit, but they do assisted suicide there. And, you know, he talked about also the pressures. This was a Swiss novelist, talked about the pressures of, you know, living in a happy country, quote unquote, happy countries. What if you're not happy, right? You know, and you think, what the hell's wrong with me? I'm living in Switzerland or Iceland and I'm not happy. I think one of the keys to happiness, ironically, is not to think about happiness too much. And not to demand it of yourself or of others. And I think that's one reason why the U.S., you know, is not the happiest country in the world, not even in the top 10, is that we have this pressure to be happy. You know, one historian calls it the unhappiness of not being happy, which is a particularly American malady, you know, because we're so pro-happiness. We invented the smiley face here, and it's in our founding document, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, that we think if we're not happy, there must be something wrong with us. And that is ironically very detrimental to actual happiness. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Oh, see, did we talk to Sue in Janesville? I think we did. Or did we? Yeah, we did talk with Sue in Janesville. I'm sorry. Well, in Switzerland, you did talk about a feeling of biophilia, I think, proximity to nature. And that's kind of an important part of Switzerland.
Yes. Biophilia is a great term coined by Edward Wilson, the great naturalist. And it's a fancy word for a simple concept, which is nature makes us feel good. And lots of studies prove this, that we are more relaxed, were more creative in nature, and all happy places. And they can be cities, but they still have a connection. All happy places have a connection to the land. They have parks in their cities. They have access to nature. The Swiss, you know, you can be a Swiss banker living in Zurich and, you know, living a very urban existence, but there's still at his heart, that Swiss banker is still going to be a mountain man who thinks of himself as someone who's most at home up in the Alps. And having regular access to nature, getting your nature fix, as a friend of mine calls it, is hugely important.
And I'm thinking back to Iceland as well, because people there, I mean, you can be in the city, but in 5 minutes you can be in these open spaces and in a very different kind of environment.
Yeah, it is. You know, Reykjavik, the capital, is just barely a city. I mean, it is a city. But you turn the corner and you see some volcano or some sea or some topographical feature that just reminds you that you are part of nature and that nature is not far away, even in the heart of this, you know, otherwise, you know, pretty cosmopolitan place.
Eric Weiner is our guest today. His book is titled The Geography of Bliss. It's great to have him with us. Certainly, you can join in, too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Talking with Eric Weiner on the show today for our first book club program. His book is called The Geography of Bliss, and having a lot of fun talking with him about it and the places that he visited. We've talked about a few of them, haven't gotten to all of them yet, but questions for him or comments of your own, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. And the email address is ideas@WPR.org. You know, Denise in Waukegan, Illinois, joins in. Let's go there. Denise, thanks for calling.
Hi. My comment is that I have not read the book. However, I do you folks off and on. I'm kind of getting back into it. But regardless, that comment about, and I'm probably paraphrasing, but that in the States, we think too much about happiness. We, you know, you're better off to just say, I know what I was going to say, and it, that happiness is a choice. And so in the moment, you make a choice. I can be happy or not be happy. And that doesn't mean bubbly and excited and all that. It's just kind of a overall feeling.
Denise, thank you for calling. Eric, a comment.
I think to some extent happiness is a choice. But the culture, and this is the point of my book, is the culture that we're in sort of indirectly limits our choices or expands our choices. And we're not aware of. Of the extent that the culture, the sea that we're swimming in, affects our happiness and affects what choices we realize are available to us. You know, an example is in Japan, where I lived for several years. It is, I think, more of an introverted nation, and if you are a very outgoing, extroverted person, you're not necessarily going to fit in Japan, and you may not feel that you do have a choice to be happy in the way you want to be happy.
Thank you again, Denise, for calling. I want to go back to Bhutan. I'm not even sure if we mentioned that. I smiled when I saw in the book that you once asked NPR if you could be cover Bhutan as part of your job.
Well, or at least to travel the world as sort of the happiness correspondent. And that's, you know, that is, I wouldn't say it's a problem of journalism. It's a function of journalism that you focus on the more negative aspects of life and humanity. That is perhaps the way it needs to be. But it just struck me as a foreign correspondent that I was missing out on a lot of the goodness that was out there, on a lot of these different cultures that were not making headlines because they weren't at war, they hadn't suffered an earthquake, but they were solving these universal problems, including the quote-unquote problem of happiness, in very instructive ways, let's put it that way.
Well, and they, Bhutan coined the GNH, or gross national happiness. Explain that and maybe how its effects, or how it's affected the rest of the world.
Right.
Maybe.
So, yeah, listeners may or may not be familiar with this, but it's fascinating. It dates back to the 1970s, actually, when the king at the time of Bhutan, this Himalayan country, sandwiched between India and China, he was asked, you know, what about the gross national product of your country, small country? And he said, I'm more concerned with the gross national happiness. And I think he just said it on the fly as like a quip, but it became actually policy because he was king, you know, who was going to stop him of the land. And it's really accelerated in the last few decades. And it doesn't mean that everyone in Bhutan is happy. This is a common misconception. I like to think of it this way. It's like if everyone had one role of playing soccer, and then someone said, well, let's change the rules of soccer a little bit. That doesn't mean someone who suggests that is the best soccer player, but you're going to change the rules a bit. And so that's what the Bhutanese have done. They said basically, and maybe instead of focusing so much on money and gross national product, we should measure national success by another metric, by happiness. And they've been working on it, working on coming up with metrics to measure happiness on a national level. And the idea has caught on in France and the UK to some extent, less so in this country, interestingly. But they've sort of exported this idea of gross national happiness, and ministers from various, mostly European countries fly in to talk to the Bhutanese about how they do this.
Mike in Madison, it's your turn. We'll give you a chance. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking the call. I'm just wondering if there's any way you could sort through this and see how much might be simply genetic. If Iceland's a very homogeneous country, and maybe their genes have been selected over time by the people who could sail across the water successfully, and the unhappy people wouldn't have taken that adventure, and they just have adventurous, positive, optimistic genes, and if that's possible.
Is it in the genes? Mike wants to know, kind of.
Yeah, good question. In a word, no. I really don't think it is. I think, you know, that we're all born with certain predispositions genetically, but those are potentialities, so that we're born with a happiness range. I'm speaking of individuals, right? So, you know, you, Larry, could be X happy or Y happy, you know, depending on your circumstances. I don't think there's a happiness gene. I don't think that's what explains why, you know, certain places are happier than others. I think that it is cultural. And if Icelandic people are happier than others, it's not their genes, but the Icelandic culture that makes them so.
Yeah. Another listener emailed to ask if a homogenous population seems to play a part in the happiest countries.
Yeah, I wish I had a simple answer for that. You take a country like Iceland, which is very happy and very homogenous. Then you look at a country like Japan that is very homogenous, but not particularly happy in terms of these surveys. I think that it's easier to have a happy country if it's homogenous. I think it's more challenging if it's an ethnically diverse population. But, and this is my personal view, is that if you can achieve it in an ethnically diverse population, you'll have reached a higher level of happiness, a richer form of it. But it's not clear cut to just say, oh, you know, it's too easy to say, oh, those Scandinavian countries are happy because, you know, they're all the same. I think that explains part of it, but doesn't explain the whole picture.
Yeah. Great Britain tried an experiment in one of its most unhappy cities, tried to make them happy. You write about that in your book.
Yes, this is the Great Experiment of Slough, which is about as happy as the name sounds. It's located a couple hours from London. It's always been the brunt of jokes, going back to a early 20th century poem that poked some fun at Slough. And The Office, the UK original version of The Office, was set in Slough. So it is your sort of poster child in the UK of your unhappy place. And the BBC a number of years ago decided they were going to use this science of happiness and see if they can make it happier. So they had a bunch of blissologists descend on Slough and do a bunch of experiments and exercises to try to get people to be happier. Results were mixed, let's put it that way. The British tend to be very suspicious of all these transatlantic ideas, as they call them very politely, especially if there's hugging involved. But it raises an interesting question of, can you take an unhappy place and make it happy? Can you change your culture? It's tricky. It takes a lot and this is both good or bad and bad. It takes a lot to make a country happier, but it takes a lot to make it less happy. I mean, I just read a survey that just came out a few days ago showing that, you know, globally there's hardly a dip in happiness in the year 2020, despite the pandemic and everything that's been going on. It takes a lot to move that happiness needle one way or another.
Yeah, although I did see a survey that showed that the United States went from, I think, 24th in your time period to now we're all the way up to 18th.
We have bumped up a little bit, I believe. It varies from year to year, but we've gone up a bit. But, you know, if you look at our increased wealth over the past half century, on a per capita GDP basis, we're maybe four or five times wealthier, but we're not four or five times happier, that's for sure.
Yeah. In terms of, you know, you've traveled so much. I've been fortunate to have traveled a lot myself in all parts of the world. Does travel help make us happy?
It's a good question. It certainly helps us see differently. You know, Henry Miller, the American writer, once said that when it came to travel, one's destination is never a place, but a new way of looking at things. And that is my philosophy of travel as well. The point is not to experience pleasure or happiness per se, although that can be nice, don't get me wrong, but to acquire a new way of looking at things. Not more knowledge necessarily, but a new vision, a new way of looking at things. And, you know, so often we just think that things just are this way, when in fact they're just this way here and now. And that is the benefit of travel, I think.
Yeah. At some point, I forget where in the book, but at some place you said travel is the capacity to jostle our souls.
Yes.
I like that.
Travel at its best. And, there's all kinds of travel. You can go lie on a beach for a week, or you can immerse yourself in a culture for a year, and there's everything in between. But if you're not going to change your outlook or change the rhythm of your life, my feeling is, what's the point?
Yeah. And near the end of the book, or I guess at the end of the book, you moved to Miami maybe to find happiness, but didn't work out that way.
Well, there's the burden of paradise, of living in a part of the country that everyone considers paradise. I don't know if you have that problem in Wisconsin, but in Miami, too. It's everyone, when I was living in Miami, everyone assumed I was happier because I was living in this semi-subtropical paradise. And again, it goes back to that pressure to be happy. You know, I conclude at the end of the book that happiness is never something we should strive for directly. It's always a byproduct of the life lived well. John Stuart Mill, the English philosopher, said that happiness should be approached sideways like a crab. And I like that.
Oscar Levance, I think, said happiness is not what you experience. It's something you remember. I kind of like that. And that is, I think, the end of our conversation here. Boy, this has been a lot of fun, Eric. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Larry. And I'm honored to be, I think, the inaugural book of your book club. Is that correct?
That is correct indeed. And we purposely picked your book because it's such a lovely book. Thank you.
All right. Well, you're off to a great start, and wishing you and everyone out there in Wisconsin much happiness.
Eric Weiner, his book, The Geography of Bliss. It was a lot of fun talking with him, and we're going to talk about some connection to certain places and how maps are often symbols of our special bond. That next, right after the news. I'm Larry Mueller.